From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's been a year now since a policy from leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was leaked to the public and an uproar began. For years, these leaders had been discussing what to do about the members of their church who were gay and wanted to be married or who had already gotten married after the Supreme Court ruled on the issue. The policy they came up with classified same-sex Mormon couples as apostates and banned their children from baby blessings and baptisms. The Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack talked to a local church leader about the policy, and he told her it felt like a sucker punch to my gut by a member of my own team. We're going to spend 2 days on this issue, and today we'll begin by talking about what happened, how the policy came about, what it tells us about Mormon leadership, and how the faithful are reacting. So join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's been almost exactly a year since a policy issued by LDS church leaders became public. For years, these leaders had been discussing what to do. Openly gay people were attending their churches. Younger Latter-day Saints seemed to be tolerant about same-sex marriage. They seemed to be worried about that. Families of LGBT people were looking for some kind of guidance. So were local leaders. The policy they came up with labeled same-sex couples as apostates, and it said if they had kids living with them, those kids couldn't get baby blessings or be baptized. They could join the church after they were 18, the policy said, but only if they disavowed the behavior of their parents. So in the aftermath, there have been protests and resignations and, of course, lots of questions about the impact of a policy like that, about the way the faithful have reacted, questions about the way gay Latter-day Saints have reacted. And then there's this question, how did this happen? That is, how did a policy like this come to be? What were the just basic mechanics of the process? That's the part of the question we're going to try and tackle today. We're doing back-to-back programs, actually, on this policy. Tomorrow we'll discuss the impact. Today we're exploring how this happened. Kendall Wilcox is joining us. He's a documentary filmmaker, a Mormon LGBT activist. He's working on this project called Far Between, which explores what it means to be gay and Mormon. He's also founder of the Empathy First Initiative, which is aimed at changing the tone of public discourse on divisive social issues. And we should also mention Wilcox is gay and an active member of the LDS Church and joining us again here in the studio. And Kendall Wilcox, welcome back.
Thank you, Doug.
Gregory Prince is also back with us today, an independent historian, also an active Mormon. He's written biographies of LDS Church President David O. McKay and church historian Leonard Arrington. He co-authored an article called Gerontocracy and the Future of Mormonism. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. He's joining us today from public radio station WAMU in Washington. And Gregory Prince, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Doug. Nice to be back.
I should say we invited a representative of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to join us on the program. The church has declined. They did send us links to clarifications on the policy made by President Russell M. Nelson and Elder D. Todd Christofferson. We're going to actually play some clips from some of those comments a little bit later on the program. We'll make them available, those comments, all of them, on our website, radiowest.org. Okay, I wanted to begin. First, Kendall Wilcox and Gregory Prince, talk about how it is you know what you know, to the degree that you can. The stories that we're going to talk about are, in some cases, private deliberations. You're publicly talking about some of all of this. How do you know what you know, to the degree you can explain that? Have you sort of corroborated what you know?
Correct, yeah. Yeah, from my perspective, this is mostly coming from, again, my work on the Far Between Project and then also the podcast Out in Zion that similarly explores what it means to be LGBT and Mormon. And there's a group of contributors on that podcast who, after the policy and then again after President Nelson's statements about sort of how the policy came into being, we decided that there was a need within the community that we're a part of to find more more of the details, understand more of the details, not necessarily to contradict the official statements, but to amplify an understanding of what's going on. And
what
so,
happened.
Yeah. So, because part of our approach to all this is that we, our understanding of ourselves, the stories we tell ourselves within this community, Mormon and LGBT, these stories are still so impoverished of complexity. We're so almost adverse to complexity. We're prone towards simplistic explanations. And that impoverishes us spiritually, in our opinion. And so we sought out to find the complexity behind the simplistic story. And so we reached out to anybody, literally, that we could get our hands on and try to piece together a narrative of how this took place. And this is this includes people sort of in all echelons of the church community, most of which, let's just be honest and up front, most of which, after sharing their little bits of understanding, said, I can never, ever go on public about this because my job or my standing in the community or my standing in the church would be in jeopardy. And so we're, of course, you know, honoring that confidentiality.
Greg Prince, talk about what, if you can, what you know, and explain why you think it's important to understand. I mean, this is a very mechanical sort of deliberative process that we're going to discuss part of the program today. Why is that important that people know that part?
Well, this is a very important issue for church members generally, but the farther down the age demographic you go, I think the more important it becomes. It becomes almost the issue for millennials. You asked earlier how I got into the information loop on this. About 4 years ago, I was asked to join the Board of Directors of Affirmation, which is the oldest LGBT-affirming group of Mormons. It's an independent organization. And months after that, I decided to tackle the story of Proposition 8 and specifically the Mormon Church role in Prop 8, but quickly found that the story was much larger than that. So the book project that I'm now 3 years into goes back to the late 1960s and looks really at a half century of the Mormon Church's involvement in LGBT issues. The combination of being on the Board of Affirmation and working on the book already put me into contact with a lot of information sources. So when this story broke a year ago, there was no need to go out and develop new sources. I already had them.
Okay, so let's start. And we should mention, I guess, first of all, is that this discussion in the upper echelons of the Mormon hierarchy had been going on for several years. They were sort of trying to figure out, as I mentioned in the introduction, Kendall Wilcox, what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, I mean, it was sort of widely known that the church, from a legal perspective, had understood years in advance of the Supreme Court decision here in the United States, let alone other countries, that, in a sense, the legal battle over same-sex marriage was all but over and just needed to play itself out through the courts. And they knew that a good 3.5 years out from 2015. And so these discussions, to one degree or another, yeah, were taking place for years.
And as I understand it, these men met on various occasions, considered various approaches. Mm-hmm. But Greg Prince, I want to hear you on this too. But as I understand it, they couldn't really come to an agreement. They hadn't found consensus on a particular policy. Is that right?
Well, let me take the timeline back even further. In 1984, Dallin Oaks, who then was a junior member of the Quorum of the Twelve, now is second in line for the presidency of the church, wrote a memo that foreshadowed what the church may eventually have to confront as LGBT rights proceeded. And he really laid out almost a playbook for what the church might consider doing, looking at various types of rights, but then specifically looking at the issue of same-sex marriage. So this was on their screen more than three decades ago. Their initial responses were to try to abort the process of legalization either at the ballot box, as was the case with Prop 22 and Prop 8 later on, or within the legislature, as they had tried to do in the state of Hawaii.
Those didn't work, obviously, so they had to readjust. So has Elder Oaks, who we should point out is a, I think most agree, great legal mind, former state Supreme Court justice, has he been driving sort of the legal part of some of these questions?
Well, that's the assumption that I hear from all quarters, and not only on this but other legal issues. Even though he's not the only attorney represented in the Quorum of the Twelve, he tends to be their go-to person because of the depth of his experience and his acknowledged expertise and intellectual prowess.
Okay, but this is important that, Kendall, they couldn't come to a consensus. They couldn't agree.
I think that is important to note, that before we heard about the policy, it was clear that they had not come to a consensus among the top brethren of the church.
Had that policy been proposed?
Yes.
That idea?
Correct, yeah. The policy had been proposed, by all accounts, by Lance Wickman, formerly of the Quorum of the 70 and now the General Council of the Church, who had been proposed, and they literally took it almost word for word, borrowed from the existing policy on how to handle children of polygamist households.
Yeah.
Took that and
so
laid that out.
So the apostate language, too, was in there?
Yes.
Yep.
Yep. Okay. Oh, absolutely. And but they put that forward as an early, shall we say, early draft proposal of something that might be considered. And that was part of the deliberations that took place over months
and
with no
they,
consensus.
What did they think? What did some of the – I mean, obviously, if they didn't vote on it then and didn't bring it forward then, not everyone agreed with that idea. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think that's what no consensus means, right? the details of which I never got access to, right? About like who brought forward which objections, who brought forward sort of the approving points. But clearly not everybody agreed that they found that there were potential problems either from a legal perspective or from just a basic public affairs, you know, or even just from the considerations that they always have present in their mind in terms of considering themselves advocates of Christ's love and custodians of his doctrine. You know, what does that behoove of them to do and act? And so based on that self-conception that they have, some of them found this to be problematic.
Greg Prince, you want to add anything to that? And maybe you could also speak to the question of why this idea of consensus is important in the Mormon hierarchy.
Well, I think in the background of this whole discussion is one of the Mormon articles of faith, which says we believe in obeying, honoring, and sustaining the law. As long as the law of the land prohibited same-sex marriage, the church was fine. When the Supreme Court made its decision in Obergefell versus Hodges, then the landscape changed entirely. Now it became an internal issue. If we obey, honor, and sustain the law, how do we deal with this new law? And so that was very much in the background, and I think even in the foreground of the discussion. The idea of consensus has been there in the Quorum of the Twelve from the very beginning of the church, that they have always operated on the basis of having lively, sometimes even contentious internal discussions, but when the decision is reached, then everybody falls in line and there is a unanimous consent for whatever they decide to do.
Right.
As Kendall was saying, these discussions were going on probably since the day that Obergefell versus Hodges was decided. And yet my information is that it had never reached the point where there was a formal proposal for an up or down vote within the quorum, that this was still in a rather loose, informal stage of discussion and hadn't moved to that proposal stage yet.
What do you know about Kendall, you mentioned that you can't really say much to the particular factions that might exist within the hierarchy of Mormonism. Greg Prince, what do you know about that? Because it's often said that you have these various factions, some arguing for a more sort of rigid approach, some arguing for a softer approach, some believing homosexuality is mostly a choice, others thinking, well, this is a biological reality that we have to deal with. What can you say about the factions that might exist that are on either sides of those issues?
In a way, I think it's appropriate to make a comparison to the United States Supreme Court, that whoever the justices are, whoever the apostles are, they are a combination of bringing whatever they are on board when they join that group and reacting to a changing environment once they get into that group. And so sometimes on the Supreme Court, you have real surprises where a justice will appear to make a complete shift in judicial philosophy long after joining the court, much to the consternation of the president who chose that justice. The same thing, I think, happens within the Quorum of the Twelve, that these men bring their life experience, they bring their own judgments, their own biases with them, but they're also susceptible to what's going on in the world to the extent that they allow themselves to tap into that. Some of them have skin in the game. They have close relatives, either siblings or children or grandchildren, who are LGBT. And right. So this can be a major factor in shaping or reshaping their view of that portion of the world once that skin becomes apparent. I think they also are aware of the fact that the biology of homosexuality, even though it's not a done deal yet, has advanced enormously over the past several decades, so that we are understanding more and more that in most individuals, homosexuality is a biological imprint. Now, the church is tacitly acknowledging that on its Mormon and gay website, yeah, where it acknowledges this is not a choice, but it hasn't gone the other half step to say this is biological. On the other hand, a lot of these men read deeply and realize that that's where the science is going.
It's interesting, Greg Prince, you posted this piece on the progressive Mormon blog, rationalfaiths.com, where you sort of talk about this sort of back and forth that seems to be going on, where you have Prop 8 in 2008, regressive, you describe it as. The Salt Lake City Non-Discrimination Ordinance in 2009, progressive. You have a talk by Boyd K. Packer in 2010, regressive. Then you have Dieter Uchtdorf, who gives this more conciliatory speech a couple of weeks after that. That's progressive. So the announcement, I guess, in November of last year of this policy, that was regressive. President Nelson, we'll talk about this, he makes this other proclamation, which sort of doubles down regressive. So I guess what you're saying is this is the way it works. There's this sort of back and forth, this maybe check and balance that goes on in this system?
I think so, but generally, if you look at other issues historically, there hasn't been quite that public face of the stutter step that we have seen with this issue, that there has tended to be a more uniform progression. Even though it has moved from point A to point B, it hasn't backtracked nearly as much as this one seems to have backtracked. And I think that's indicative that there isn't complete harmony in that governing body as to what to do on this.
Is it okay if I I think it's helpful to also understand or frame that possible dissonance that we're talking about amongst the brethren as a manifestation of a deeper dissonance, like a spiritual, psychological dissonance that not just the brethren, most members of the church experience when they are confronted by the doctrines of the church and their sense of love and empathy for LGBT people, that their heart is literally pulled in two directions. And so I think thus we see it with the brethren themselves in these actions that are seen as progressive or regressive, because again, they consider themselves custodians of Christ's doctrine on earth. That's a pretty serious self-conception. And also part of that doctrine is Christ's love. How do you do those two at the same time? And I think, again, this back and forth is a manifestation of that. So to be fair to them, that's how I see it.
Okay, so ultimately they can't come to a consensus. They sort of table the measure, right? That's sort of how I understand it. Which brings us now to a year ago today, or almost exactly that. It was November 1st, or at least I think, mm-hmm. Kendall, according to your timeline, it's mm-hmm. November 1st. And President Thomas Monson, of course, who is the president of the LDS Church, decides to act unilaterally on his own?
That's, again, from all best accounts that we can find, because, again, we go from a place of very clear, and this is almost widely known now, that very clear non-consensus to all of a sudden as of or by November 1st, this policy is sort of making its way through the decision-making process of the church, meaning President Monson at some point by November 1st has made this decision, again, which is reflective of—
He knew the way everyone else thought, but he's like, I'm going to do this anyway. And I guess he can do that, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which, again, is as we get to both Elder Christofferson and President Nelson's remarks about this, it's embedded in the way that they categorize it as well, that ultimately this was on President Monson, and he is the prophet and president of the church. And so by November 1st, it's there, and then...
How does it work? Did he has it drafted and put into words?
That or? I don't have access to, right?
Okay.
But we do know that by November 3rd, so 2 days later, the Tuesday meeting with the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, that it was presented there in that meeting.
Yeah.
And it
Hold
was,
on. But
yeah,
I
go
ahead. I want to get to something before we get to that point, because I think that's an important point, that it was when it was presented to them. What do we know, Greg Prince, about... this question of whether it was Thomas Monson acting alone or whether he was influenced by others in the 12. And I confess that's a leading question, because there are those who are suggesting that Russell Nelson was one of those who was driving this process, that he was powerfully influencing Thomas S. Monson, even manipulating is the term that I've heard as well. What can you say to that?
We know a broad outline, but we don't know all of the details yet. The church itself has acknowledged, as we talked about the last time I was on your show, that President Monson is suffering from the effects of advancing age, though they don't elaborate as to what that means. Part of this discussion is hindered by the lack of any direct input to the public from President Monson,
right,
that he has been totally silent on the issue ever since this thing came forth a year ago. So we're left trying to connect dots, and we're not even sure that we have all of those dots yet.
Wait. Can you just underscore that? He has not spoken on this matter publicly?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. It's been spokespersons speaking in his behalf, but there has been no direct statement by him, much less any type of back and forth in the way of something like a press conference that would answer some of these questions that are so vexing to so many members of the church and to outsiders as well.
It's been suggested, I want to just bring this up again, that President Monson was in fact too mentally impaired by the dementia that seems to afflict him to have either made this decision himself, or that this impairment made him vulnerable to being influenced or manipulated by others. What can we responsibly say about that, I suppose?
What I think we can responsibly say is that is the big unanswered question. Everybody is wondering about that, and we haven't received any clarification to it.
Kendall Wilcox, you want to say something about that?
I think the only thing we can say is that it's well known by now, and the church is even softly acknowledged that you know, President Monson is experiencing the effects of advancing age. While the church does say that he shows up to work every day, right, is one of the official statements, and participates in meetings, his mental capacity in those moments is not understood clearly. There's anecdotal, you know, understandings of how he shows up. I had an experience at a temple dedication in Eastern Europe with him where he was very enthusiastic and very happy to be there, but also told an entire story three times in a row, like word for word, which again, I know he prides himself in his photographic memory, but he repeated it three times. And as he started the third, President Uchtdorf, who was by his side, and I was just a couple feet away, through his perma grin, you know, President Uchtdorf leaned in and said, "Hey, you've told that story twice now." And President Monson stopped and said, I know. And then he just kept going and he finished the story word for word.
I don't think it's terribly novel or even controversial
exactly.
At this point that you have a leader in the church who
exactly.
is afflicted with dementia.
Exactly.
But I guess the question that I want you to respond to is, does that worry you then that he has been manipulated, overly influenced, not capable of making a call of this significance? You know what I mean?
Of course. I mean, I don't know. To be told, I don't know which words to use to express how it makes me feel, or to reflect what other people have felt about this. That what do we do when we have a construct of a human being here on Earth who we call a prophet, who is supposed to be a direct conduit of the will of God, who his flesh is weakened,
yeah.
Right? How do you reconcile those two? Of course, you do it with faith and trust, but then how do you have trust in a process that is flawed by the flesh? So it's hard.
Okay, I want to get to, before we get to a break, I want to get to this one more point. And that is the way this was presented then. I guess what, was it like a couple of days after this? It was then presented to the Quorum of the Twelve.
Yeah, by November 3rd, their meeting on November 3rd, it was presented to the Quorum of the Twelve. And the understanding—
As it like, this is it.
That's the understanding. And again, you know, I wasn't there.
Yeah.
So, but that's the understanding. It was less deliberative and more declarative. And the one piece of evidence that we can draw from that is that it did appear on the church's website— as other changes in handbook of instructions appear on the church's website the very next day. So that was not a very long deliberative process, shall we say. But so that's the only piece of evidence, that within 24 hours it was already on the church's website.
Greg Prince, what can you say about that? I mean, and do we have any sense of how the rest may have reacted? I mean, they had been talking about this. They hadn't come to some kind of consensus, but now they were being told a decision had been made by the president of the church. Do we have any sense of how they reacted to that?
Well, from piecing this puzzle together from multiple sources, there are two departures from their normal process that, to me, are troubling. Number one is when the issue was brought into President Monson, President Uchtdorf was not there. He was out of town. Hmm. Normally, you would expect that something of this importance would be discussed in extenso in the first presidency and then presented to the Quorum of the Twelve. The second departure was, as Kendall has said, that when it was taken to the Quorum, it was essentially taken as a done deal without discussion, and at least one influential member of the Quorum was not only not in the room, he was out of the country at the time and was not pleased to have been excluded from the discussion.
So this is so explain what happens next. It's not publicly announced. It just sort of quietly appears on this website. It's in what is called the Handbook of Instructions, right? Mm-hmm. For local church leaders, you get if you're a leader, you get a password or something. And
correct.
Yeah,
you have access to that website.
But that was it? No other word about that.
Well, no. They were notified. Local leaders were notified.
Okay.
But the insinuation even there—
But no public notice of this.
Correct. But there never is.
Right. Okay.
So the insinuation of it was quietly, you know, or even surreptitiously, or they knew what they were doing and they were going to hide. I don't buy that, because this is how it always happens. Depending on big or small changes to that handbook, the changes are made on the website. An email is automatically sent out to stake presidents and local leaders notifying them, hey, you should know, here are the changes, here's the reference. So it was a matter of fact, and they weren't hiding anything, which I think is very important to say, just because of the way the story then ensued from there, that it insinuated that this was somehow under the cloak of secrecy. It wasn't.
It's Kendall Wilcox, who's director of the ongoing film project Far Between and the founder of the Empathy First Initiative, joining us here in the studio. Gregory Prince is an independent historian, author of the forthcoming article Gerontocracy and the Future of Mormonism. He's joining us from the public radio station WAMU in Washington. As I mentioned, we invited a representative of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to join us on the program today. They declined, but we have details and information from the LDS Church on our website at radiowest.org. We're going to take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring how the LDS Church's controversial policy on same-sex marriage came about. It was a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, when this policy change was leaked to the public. The church didn't send out a press release, didn't say anything at first. Church leaders had decided Mormons who had entered into same-sex marriages would be classified as apostates, and their children would be barred from church rituals and ordinances, couldn't be baptized, for example. So today in the program, we're talking about the mechanics of that decision. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about the impact. Today, though, what happened? Kendall Wilcox is with us, director of the film project Far Between and the founder of the Empathy First Initiative. Gregory Prince is with us, an independent historian. And we also have with us Richard Holzapfel, who is professor of church history at Brigham Young University, where he teaches courses on the New Testament and on the Doctrine and Covenants, a former president of the Alabama-Birmingham Mission, currently serves as president of the Provo Young Single Adult First Stake. And so, President Holzapfel, welcome to you. Thanks
Glad
for being
be
with
here.
Us. I want to fold you into the conversation here, President, in just a moment. I want to get your sense of sort of the general reaction to all of this. Can I take care of a few more things first before
Please.
We get there? Because I want to get to this question of how this then becomes public. Kendall Wilcox, it gets leaked, basically? Is that
Yeah, I'm not actually comfortable with that term. I know that's
Is that right?
That's how it played in the story. I guess you can call it leak, but it's not so surreptitious. I mean, it was very simply, it followed the normal pattern of letting local leaders know that there's a change in the handbook, and then it was at least two that I spoke to, two local leaders, one from the Seattle area and one from the Utah area.
Like a bishop?
A bishop and a high councilman who saw it, you know, got the normal notification.
Yep.
Even got a further notification in the case of Seattle from their stake president because of particular things that had transpired there for a year around LGBT issues, and then saw it, and then they just forwarded it to a number of different Mormon bloggers, some of whom couldn't believe it, didn't believe it, and chose not to even say anything about it, and then others who said, oh, wow, this is crazy, and put it out there, and then from there, the firestorm.
Because the cat was out of the bag
exactly.
at that point anyway.
Yeah. Hey,
Doug, let me weigh in here, too.
Yeah, please.
Consider what we're talking about here, that at the very least, when that email went out giving access to local leaders to the revision in the Church Handbook of Instructions, you're talking about 3,000 stake presidents and 30,000 bishops
wow.
who knew about it before Church Public Affairs knew about it. That's the missing link in all of this. How in the world could you formulate a policy that anybody looking at it in advance would realize would be creating a firestorm, and yet the organization within the church that's set up to be proactive to get out in front of stories is immediately scrambling and stays behind this story for weeks, if not months?
Why? I mean, if you have a policy that, I mean, look, these are very astute people. They know there's going to be a reaction. I'm guessing they think it's going to be fairly emotional and somewhat controversial. Why not work it through the PR department?
Well, I can't answer that question.
Yeah.
But to me, what this does say is it is further evidence of the process by which it came about, that it was not
Wasn't
taken
consensus.
Through its normal process of consensus among the brethren, and then completely private discussion within different departments like public affairs or the priesthood and family executive council.
That's the other part of the protocol.
Exactly. Absolutely. Even down to the editing department, you know, that individuals who have no real authority except to edit, you know, for stylistic points, it didn't go through them either. And so this is further evidence of just how quickly it went from President Monson to the website.
Now, this part of the story I want to ask you about, because it starts to get really interesting, because Elder Todd Christofferson of the Quorum of the Twelve, by some accounts, was worried about the way this was playing out, wanted the church to make some kind of a statement, wanted the church to give some sort of clarification. Kendall Wilcox, what can you say about that? That he went to certain leaders to say, look, we got to mm-hmm. clarify all mm-hmm. of this. What can you say? What do we know about
well,
that?
Well, it's really important to understand too that he went to his leaders in the capacity as the chair of the Church Public Affairs Department. So it literally is his job as one of the apostles to advise the senior apostles on issues of public affairs. And so he was doing his job by reading public reaction within the church and outside the church, but more important to him inside the church you know, reacting to this policy change, and made the recommendation that, as they do sometimes, that they should make some sort of clarifying statements, again, to clarify the details, but also to help people emotionally and spiritually wrap their sort of heads and hearts around this. He took that to his senior leadership, and again, according to our accounts, asked or suggested that one of them be the spokesperson for this messaging.
You're talking about the first presidency.
Correct. Not President Monson himself, but maybe the first presidency or President Nelson as president of the Quorum of the Twelve.
Who is the senior leader of the church.
Correct. And who, in a sense, is in a very real sense, president or Elder Christofferson's boss.
Yep.
Right?
They said no. We're not going to deal with it.
Not us. Okay. Yeah. But deferred back to him in his capacity as chair of public affairs department.
Say, we're not going to say anything. You take care of it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. In a sense, that's
should
not
they,
in these
should
words.
They have, but should they have?
Yeah. Yeah. On a moral level is what we're talking about, right? The moral responsibility that they might have within this religious relationship we have with them. Yeah.
Elder Christofferson plays an interesting position, plays an interesting role here for one particular reason. He's in his brother is gay,
mm-hmm.
Which doesn't necessarily say anything about his positions on any of these things. He's, I'm guessing, and as I think you can tell, in lockstep with his brother on the doctrinal question. Is it fair to say, though, he was a little disturbed about the way this played out, or can we even say?
From what he indicated, like you said, he was in lockstep. And so beyond that, I think we'd be going into speculation,
okay.
Personal speculation.
Okay. Greg Prince, can you add anything?
Yeah, I think we can speculate on that. And the exercise that I would suggest is that people go on the website and pull up the video interview that Mike Otterson did the following day with Elder Christofferson and turn the volume off. Watch the body language. That will tell you volumes.
What do you mean?
Meaning that he was uncomfortable to the point of being anguished at having to deal with this issue that had spun out of control. It doesn't signal where he may have been doctrinally, but it signals that he was in a most uncomfortable position and probably would rather have done anything except be in that room at that time.
I want to play a moment from that video that you mentioned because he seems unequivocal in the sort of doctrinal question. Here's one of the responses that Elder Christofferson, again, he's from the LDS Quorum of the Twelve, in response to the head of the PR at the time, Michael Otterson, a question that he had about this.
We regard same-sex marriage as a particularly grievous or significant, serious kind of sin that requires church discipline. It means the discipline is mandatory. It doesn't dictate outcomes, but it dictates that discipline is needed in those cases. It's a statement to remove any question or doubt that may exist. We recognize that same-sex marriages are now legal in the United States and some other countries, and that people have the right if they choose to enter into those, and we understand that. But that's not a right that exists in the church. That's the clarification.
Okay, so this is going to get us to Richard Holzapfel, who's joining us. And I don't mean to sort of leave you out of the discussion so far. I, in fact, may see if you can join us a bit tomorrow when we continue the conversation. But how did you react to when you heard that sort of video clarification? We'll come to that in a moment. But give me your first general reaction. As an active Latter-day Saint, as a devoted person who believes in the capacity of his leaders to receive revelation from God and all of those things.
Yeah, thank you. I am very sensitive to the LGBTQ community because I have members in my own ecclesiastical responsibility. I have family, I have friends, and also as a university professor, I'm really, my whole life is tied around millennials every day. I'm dealing with this group, and so very sensitive to the issue. So obviously I wanted to listen very carefully because I knew I would need to talk to people, also my own feelings. My first reaction, though, was that I know these men. Some of them, I know them personally. And so I know who they are, what they say in private. I've spent time with them. I've eaten at their homes. I've been in meetings with them. And I've been involved in the various coordinating councils of the church. So I've kind of watched them over the years. I have some experience there. I don't know the details on this exact project, but I do know that generally this is this comes after much consideration, deliberation, prayer, meditation, and sometimes it takes weeks, it takes months, it takes years. So I'm not sure I would characterize the fast pace that has been outlined here. I think that really is speculative. No matter what anecdotal information people might have, my experience is the opposite. I believe them to be sincere, and I believe them to be people of love. Elder Christofferson, I think if you listen to his talks, you read anything he's done, you've watched him even you know, in a meeting, here's a man who is gentle and kind, committed to what he believes the principles of Christ's church, the gospel, but also concerned about individuals. So I knew that maybe the media was spinning this in a way, and I cautioned people as I talked to them, either groups or as individuals, to be careful not to filter the story through the news media. Okay. But what is your experience with church leaders? What do you know about these men? And give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's not take the worst case scenario here, and let's give them as much sympathy and charity is that we want to give everyone, and particularly the group that I deal with, and my experience is there's a lot of charity for LGBTQ individuals, and particularly among millennials. So I think my reaction might have been different than some others.
Yeah. Does it at all trouble you that there was some – they didn't agree. They might not have agreed. And that President Monson sort of just acted unilaterally. He may have been influenced by President Nelson, even though everyone they hadn't come to a decision, but they acted anyway. I mean, that sort of strategic maneuvering, all of that stuff, does that give you pause at all as an active member?
I mean, it gives me pause in the sense that somebody speculates that, because my experience is exactly the opposite. In every council,
so you don't think that's what happened?
I don't think that's what happened. I don't think it's maybe an ideal utopian vision of people coming together and just all saying we all agree. I know there's the give and take because I've been in those meetings as a local leader. I think this if the data ever comes out and it's possible to ever get the whole story on this, I don't think it's going to be as quick paced and as influential. Every meeting I go to, when it's reported by church officers, I'm talking about 70s or members of the 12, is that yes, President Monson is showing the signs of aging, but they table things when he is not in a position to make a decision, and that they really do believe in putting things on the table, waiting, even if it takes years. So I don't see this idea that somehow he was forced into it. It just goes against all my experience.
So somebody manipulating an old man, you don't buy that?
I don't.
I wanted to ask about, we sort of come to this question of January. And Kendall Wilcox, take us through what happens here, because this is an important part of the story. For those observing the process, this was a really significant moment. President Nelson, I guess that's what we call him, President.
Yes.
He delivers this speech in Hawaii. It's this worldwide devotional. And it was here where he seemed to go at this question of whether this change that had happened, this policy that had happened in November, was a policy or a revelation. Now, if there are any non-Mormons listening at this point of the program, they haven't a clue what that means. Mm-hmm. Would you explain, and Greg Prince, I want to hear you on this, and Richard Hutzfeld, I want to hear you on this as well. Before we get to what President Nelson did, declaring it a revelation, as I understand it, what's the difference? Somebody explain that to me.
I'm not the best person to talk about that, only because my conception of it is that it's all, at least from a church perspective, it's all the same. If it comes from the brethren,
who
cares? It comes from God.
Okay, it comes from God. Okay.
So, Greg Prince, but there are distinctions that matter to people.
Well,
yes.
This seems important. Greg Prince, what do you make of that?
Well, if you look at the nearly two-century scope of church history and try to put these things in context, one level I would call, we mean this. And another level I would call, we really mean this. And yet, if you look at that two-century span of history, even things where we said, we really mean this, sometimes get changed later on. Even if the R word, revelation, has been applied in the past, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's immutable. If you look at that two-month window—
And by R word, you mean revelation?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you look at that two-month window between early November and early January, what was happening? And the answer is that through surrogates, some members of the Quorum of the Twelve were leaking that, look, this is a temporary policy. It will be short-lived. It will change. And once you understand that, then you can understand why President Nelson, trying to restore order and to stop those leaks in the facade, would play that card, which is what he did. And in playing that card, he effectively stopped those leaks. Now, that may have created other problems farther down the road, but at least the proximate problem was fixed.
What do we mean by playing the card? Explain what he said in that speech that was significant.
When he called it revelation, then that stopped the dissent. It stopped the leaks.
In other words, this came right from God. This was God's will.
Yes.
And if I can, you know, put a finer point on that, just to quote from him, he describes, you know, this was his way of doing what we're doing here, really, is painting the narrative of how the policy came about and putting an official stamp on how it came about. And so in his description, he referred to a moment when the change was presented by President Monson to the Quorum of 15, the Council of 15. And he explained, and I'm quoting here, he said, "When the Lord inspired his prophet Thomas S. Monson to declare the mind of the Lord and the will of the Lord, each of us during that sacred moment felt a spiritual confirmation. It was our privilege as apostles to sustain what had been revealed to President Monson." And to me—
In other words, this wasn't just flawed human beings trying to discern God. We got this one right. This was God.
Mm-hmm.
God wants gay people to be labeled apostates.
Definitely not the effects of an ailing man under the influences of you know, whisper campaigns.
Yeah.
This was God, and the fact that he said they had a witness as apostles. And that evoked language that had not been evoked in church parlance or in church communities since the 1978 revelation on blacks in the priesthood. So that's pretty serious languaging.
Richard Holtzfeld, what do you make of that? How are you reacting?
Again,
to that?
Because I'm coming maybe from a little different position, having been in training meetings, been in council meetings, watching, I think I take Elder Nelson, President Nelson, at his word. I think he is describing what he believes is the process by which decisions come together. It's thoughtful, it's cautious, it's careful. And only then, at this moment, do they all say, we feel that this is the right way to go. Now, the interpretation of the policy can become problematic by how people interpret it. But the fact that the Lord wanted something here, this negotiation between church doctrine, but also sensitivities for members of the LGBTQ community,
right,
which include many Latter-day Saints.
Right. But what does that tell you then? How do you interpret that? Do you interpret it that then, does this tell you something about the mind of God, that it is God who wants same-sex couples to be labeled apostates and their children to be kept from blessings and baptisms until they're 18?
I have taken, and I've had this own experience. I've lived in Israel. I've had friends who've investigated the church who wanted to be baptized, and we've said no, because of a policy. I have friends who are from Saudi Arabia or from Jordan, Muslims, Pakistanis, who want to be baptized, and we have said no. And we do that because of compassion. We don't want someone who would join the church, and their joining the church would cause a problem. This challenge between faith and family is so important. And so I take Elder Christofferson at his word. I believe him when he says this policy is born out of love and concern for children. The idea is that in a faith community, how does someone negotiate parents who have chosen to be married, same-sex marriage, and then their children are coming to church teaching that that is not the proper way? We put a child in such a vulnerable position. So the idea is to allow them. And Latter-day Saint theology is expansive. We don't believe that there's salvation in a moment. very core to our belief is that God saves people based on what they do, but the desires of their heart. So this friend of mine in Tel Aviv who is unable to join the church because of our policy of the state of Israel of not converting Jews because of, let's be honest, it's a sensitivity post-Holocaust about conversion, and Muslims who might go home and be threatened either by family or culture or even the state and others, I really believe the policy is we're worried about that individual. So it's not we don't like children. It's we are really concerned about children. So that's how I read the policy.
Okay. We're running out of time, and I want to get to what happens next with the policy. Greg Prince, you've suggested two scenarios. You think President Nelson may move to canonize the policy, which he seems to have done, or his colleagues in the 12 will begin this process of maybe walking the policy back or adjusting it. What do you and Kendall, I want to hear all of you actually on this. What do you figure happens next with something like this? Greg Prince,
I think
you start.
Time only will tell. Some things change when the composition of the Quorum of the Twelve changes. Some things change when the world changes. And I think we'll have to adopt a wait-and-see attitude. It's not at the discretion of the laity to press the decision that the Quorum of the Twelve might make on it. But if you look historically, even on issues where everybody was sure that this is the way it is today and this is the way it will be forever, sometimes that changes, and I think we need to leave ourselves open to the possibility of a change, particularly in a church whose bedrock principle is continuing revelation.
Yeah, in private conversations that I've had with members of Church Public Affairs and elsewhere, the sentiment is that this is not complete. What that means, what that looks like in terms of ramifications, I don't really know. But this sense that this isn't resolved, this isn't complete, it's not clear, is to me probably the most accurate answer to the question that you're asking. But I also do want to add this idea that I don't personally see the more nuanced, complex description that we've given today and that's been out there for now for a year, or almost a year, about how this came about as being antithetical to President Nelson's description of the process. In my mind, I genuinely believe that in his mind, in his heart, it's one and the same. He just chose, as probably many good leaders would choose, to not get off into the weeds, as it were, of the details, to just describe it in more simple terms. And I don't think, as a lot of people that I do know, feel that was disingenuous, that he didn't tell the whole story, and therefore he was somehow hiding or misleading. I don't agree with that sentiment.
Okay. Richard Holtzup, give your final word on that.
I like what Kendall just said. I think this is really important. I think my experience with these men, being in their presence, knowing them, and some of them personally, is that they're sincere. And I think, you know, we have what did Jesus say, but why did he say it, or what's the context? This is a historian's approach trying to unpack the statement. So we have the statement. So the question is, what does it mean? And I think the new website, Mormon and Gay, very interesting name, Mormon and Gay, is full of diversity, love, and hope. And I think that is going to interpret this policy. And certainly as a church leader, I know my experience is that I'm to deal with this as individual based on the Holy Spirit. So this is not like a high wall that has blocked us in.
Okay. There's more to say, and we'll get you to say that tomorrow. Richard Holtzapfel, professor of church history at Brigham Young University, a state president in Provo. Glad you came up to join us. Thank you very much. Gregory Prince, an independent historian, author of the forthcoming article, Gerontocracy and the Future of Mormonism. Glad you took the time. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug.
And Kendall Wilcox, director of the ongoing film project Far Between and the founder of Empathy First Initiative. Thanks a lot. We'll see you tomorrow as well.
Yes,
okay,
thank you.
Great. Thanks very much. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.